This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, February 10th, 1916. Let's go to Chicago, Illinois. Let me try and paint the scene here. It's the evening. There is a large gathering of some of the most prominent people in the city at the Stately University Club. We're talking elected officials, business leaders, religious leaders. They're there to honor the new Roman Catholic Archbishop George Mundelein. It also happens to be Abraham Lincoln's birthday as well. They're celebrating that. But really, this is all about the new Roman Catholic Archbishop. The most elite of Chicago high society are there. Now, we don't have historical weather data. I looked this up going back that far. I can't tell you exactly the weather on February 10th, 1916, but I'm going to go ahead and say that it was very cold outside, which means that if you're inside, exactly, which means that if you're inside and you need to warm up, what are you probably going to eat, Nikki Kelly? What's your go-to warm-up food?
A little lentil soup,
Midwest
chili. I was going to say chili.
Chili.
Stew.
Okay.
Well, beef stew. Chili.
So, soup is the subject of today's story, because that is, in fact, what happens is this crowd is served soup, and not just soup. It is poisoned soup, poisoned by what appears to be an anarchist cook who pours arsenic into the soup being served to the Chicago elite. This story is incredible. We will get to all of the details of the mass soup poisoning attempt, 1916 Chicago, with, you heard their voices already, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello.
Hello. You don't see that in the row of Campbell soups that you find at the store. There's no like poison soup.
It's not on the list. No arsenic flavored.
By the way, just to get this out there, Italian wedding soup is the best soup, and I don't think we need to really go beyond that. Very clearly the best
soup.
I would
cosine, go. Yeah.
If you are Italian and you're getting married, please invite me to your wedding just for the soup.
Hey, how are you both so wrong about this?
What?
Please don't say tomato.
No, tomato is too sweet. French onion. Very good.
Oh,
come on. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, New England, I should be like clam chowder. Does that count?
Where are your loyalties, Kelly?
Sure, it counts.
I know. Yeah. I'm a transplant, sorry.
Well, look, and I'm actually realizing as we discuss this that we don't know what kind of soup exactly, I don't think, in this story. But there are a lot of other details here. So look, there's a poisoning, as we've said. We'll talk about who and why and so forth. But let's talk about the immediate aftermath. Mm. This attempted poisoning, the soup goes out. It has arsenic in it. Kelly, what goes down?
Oh, it's gross. It's bad. You have hundreds of people who are vomiting, who are, you know, throwing up all over the place. They're sick. I mean, this was an event that involved about 200 people. So if you can imagine, everyone has sat down to eat and is consuming the soup and starts to feel within minutes queasy, stomach aches. And before you know it, it's become incredibly clear that everyone has been poisoned. And so people are coming up with all kinds of concoctions and makeshift things to get people to throw up, to get people to vomit or go to the bathroom. I imagine it's a lot. I keep thinking of like the scene in Bridesmaids or something where everyone gets food poison and it's just like, look away, look away.
Or that time George H.W. Bush vomited into the lap of the Japanese prime minister, which we've covered on this show, but like that times 100, right? But yes. But these attempts to get people to induce vomiting or whatever. I mean, you know, one of them is there's apparently a doctor in the room who decides to mix mustard and water and serve it to people as an emetic, which I guess is to get people to throw up. But yeah, people realize what's going down here.
It's just bad.
Yeah. And I, just to viscerally put you in the room, that has to be most disgusting room to be in. Gosh. If you have 200 people just either vomiting because they've just had poison soup or vomiting because they've swallowed. Who knew that mustard and water mixed together could make you throw up? But anyway, it's
or vomiting because other people are vomiting like that. Acid
right,
smell.
All the sensitive stomachs in there.
I like throw up just in solidarity.
And you know, of course, these people are all wearing tuxes or priestly garbs. You know, it's a whole thing. Okay, so we have this moment of the vomiting. We should say one person does die, but I think when people, if anyone does talk about this story, which not many people do, but when they do, you know, I think it is often thought of as, wow, it could have been much worse. And so there are some interesting theories as to why it was not as bad as it could have been. So let's run through a few of those.
Part of that is that because they were not expecting so many people to come, they needed to spread the soup. So they added more water to make more soup, which diluted some of the arsenic, which could be one reason why a lot of people didn't die.
So wait, I just want to pause on this because this confirms a suspicion we all have, which is they're not making more soup in that kitchen. They're just watering down the existing soup.
They're turning on the tap and just letting it go.
There were also people who suggest that maybe there was a cook who thought that the soup had spoiled and had tossed out a lot of the stock, remade it, and so there were only trace levels of arsenic in it instead of what they later found was enough arsenic to kill 200 people, right, which is quite a lot of arsenic.
So look, we just impugned a kitchen staff. This is a good sign of a kitchen staff. They are tasting the soup right before it goes out. Someone flags that something tastes off here, threw it out. And then I suppose another theory is that it actually contained so much arsenic that people didn't actually ingest it, right? When it comes out, you taste it, you're like, something's off, and you don't actually drink, you know, half the soup or whatever before you would actually get really sick or have enough to kill you. So there are all these theories about why this wasn't as bad as it could have been. Clearly, there was an intent to kill a bunch of people in Chicago high society. We're talking about hundreds of people. I mean, this would have been the biggest mass murder in Chicago history. And when people think about kind of these kinds of events, you know, just to put it in context, H.H. Holmes, the legendary serial killer from the 1890s, this probably would have eclipsed that body count in one night. I mean, this is a real dire situation that could have unfolded here. Now let's get to who, what, why, when, etc. So what is the best theory as to who is responsible for this?
So the person who gets fingered for the crime is a man named Jean Crones, who is a cook back in the kitchen, who is also, as police later discover, an anarchist. And regular listeners to the show will know that in the early 20th century, anarchists were the cause of a lot of capers and crimes in the United States, particularly assassinations and targetings of political leaders in the U.S.
Yeah, and we should also say that George Mundelein, who is the archbishop at the time, has a dual ethnic heritage. His father is German and his mother is Irish. And this is a big reason why he was chosen to be the bishop, was because he has this dual ethnic identity and thought that maybe this might be a great pick to bring people together. But it also incensed a lot of people. And I think part of these ethnic and religious divisions are what caused people to do pretty heinous acts.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of motivation, it's interesting. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you just say, okay, there's a thriving anarchist movement. There are a lot of incidences of terroristic targetings and so forth. So it makes sense. You have this room with all the elite in Chicago. It would be targeted. Mundelein himself is interesting because, by all accounts, has a real reputation of really caring about the poor and he spends a lot of his career. He had spent a lot of his career up to that point and spends a lot of his career going forward really working with immigrant communities, downtrodden communities. I mean, obviously, like, the Roman Catholic Church represents something bigger beyond just this one person's. But it is an interesting wrinkle in this story that this person seemed to be at least an ally, if not a champion, of many of these communities that the anarchist community, anarchist cause, was probably also championing as well.
Yeah. I mean, he's beloved. He's so beloved that they actually name a Chicago suburb after him. Yeah, which is funny because my sister lived in Mundelein, and I always thought, this is a funny name for a town. And come to find out, it was named after him while he was still alive, which I think is a big deal because most people don't get that honor until they're dead.
Yeah, and had Crones had his way, it would not have been named Mundelein. So she would be living in an entirely other place.
So Crones, anarchist, they discover in his apartment what is basically, a bunch of literature. He's part of the sort of anarchist community in Chicago, but also a sort of chemical lab of sorts. Nikki, is this a criminal mastermind or is this just someone who's scheming away? What do we make of Jean Crohn's, and what else do we know about him?
In order to be a criminal mastermind, I think your scheme has to work. So I don't think that he quite gets to be a criminal mastermind, but he does seem to be, again, based on the evidence of the Chicago Police Department, which we'll put a big asterisk next to that, but he does seem to be someone who was tapped into the anarchist community. He had a plot, and he carried out his plot. He was only thwarted by some quick-thinking people at the event. But he does start to rise back to mastermind status because he runs away and no one finds him.
Right. I mean, you say the plot is thwarted, but not him, right? He is not caught. Let's just imagine the scene in the movie. He slips out the back and basically slips into the night and is not found.
He never gets caught. Then he becomes like, an urban legend or sort of, I don't know, soup folklore. But like,
the soup anarchist. It's the
political boogeyman that comes to big dinner parties and freaks people out when the food tastes funny.
He does have this kind of afterlife where people, they spot a cook that kind of looks like him, and the police will go in and make an arrest, and he's spotted all across the country and becomes this kind of boogeyman that people are always seeing, like Elvis after his death.
Yeah.
Yes. This is probably my favorite part of this story, is just all of the stories about the spotting of him and, little headlines for years and years and years all around the country of people saying, oh, we think we spotted Jean Crohn's. I mean, sort of like, D.B. Cooper, who's that person who hijacked that plane and was never appeared. And then people decades later say they're still floating around. But, there's some of these articles that are showing up in, The New York Times and so forth are like, did he turn up in and regional newspapers? Did he turn up in Fayetteville, Arkansas? Is he here in New York? Anytime there's, again, suspicious soup, but just in general, people just claim that they spot him. There was one story that he'd actually become a nun in disguise. And there's a little in the Pittsburgh Daily Post a couple years later, there's a little mock-up of what Jean Crohn's would look like disguised as a nun, and maybe has entered
wild.
It's wild, and it's this amazing afterlife. There's also, for what it's worth, Jean Crohn's, we should say, is maybe a nom de soup or whatever. It's not actually maybe his name. It seems to maybe have been an Italian immigrant by another name. The sightings in Nebraska, Missouri, Arkansas, North Carolina, Colorado, Oregon, New York, Iowa City. A chef in Iowa City was arrested simply because someone took a photo and said, wait, this looks like it might be that guy from the soup incident in Chicago. And they start arresting people.
It also makes me think about the people who left the party. Are they like swearing off soup? Are they like, never again will I ever eat soup? Like, never again. Don't put that bouillon in my soup.
You would definitely want to wait until everyone else in the room had started eating just to see what happens.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Well, there I would be a delayed eater.
There is a wrinkle here where at the big St. Patrick's Day celebration, which is just about a month later after this, apparently they bring in a taster who, for an hour and a half before the meal, does a little taste of every single dish going out. And the taster survived. And, they went forward with probably a lot of the same people right back in this sort of, big St. Patrick's Day high society function. But yeah, I mean, I have not seen this in any of the accounts about whether Mundelein ever ate soup again or any of those people. I probably would never.
He didn't really eat that again. Much. I mean, according to some of the records, it's like if you've ever been, front and center stage, you don't have a whole lot of time to eat because you're too busy shaking hands and kissing babies. And like, I know even at my own wedding, I barely had two bites. It was like that bite of cake and that was it. Because you're like, oh, thank you for coming. Oh, it's a... Most of the time, you're not even having a chance to sit down and eat properly.
So that's one of the theories as to why Mundelein survived. And also, for what it's worth, same thing at a wedding. I think it's a classic thing. It's like that the couple never eats. And there is always, I think it's important at weddings, designate one of your friends and tell them, you're the person to make sure that we eat. Fix us a plate. Well, fix us a plate, because sometimes it's like... All the food is gone. And even the, so it's like, everyone I know I'm on my little wedding soapbox here, but everyone at a wedding wants a job, actually. And it's really important to give everyone a little task that they feel like they're contributing to your special day. And so designating someone as the "you're my friend who's going to make sure that we eat" is a great little task to throw someone. They feel good about it. They take it seriously. You actually eat.
I support that message.
I was really worried that you were going to say designate one of your friends the taster.
The taster. Well, there's that too. Depends what kind of wedding. If you know, if it's the opening scene of Godfather 2, right. Then maybe yes, you want a taster at your wedding. But yes,
how red your wedding is.
All right, exactly. Back on track as we wrap up. I mean, to put a bow on it, our anarchist super Jean Crohn's never caught, right? Mm-hmm. DB Cooper style, never caught. So you know,
as far as we know, never caught.
We assume that this person is dead at this point, this many years later. But yeah, it's kind of remarkable. Let's turn, as we end, to Mundelein, who has a really fascinating career in and of his own.
He does. You know, he, as you hinted at earlier, he becomes this big pro-labor voice, which is really important for connecting with working class people in Chicago. He's a big fan of the New Deal. He's a big opponent of Nazism and anti-Semitism, which is actually really important in Chicago in the 1930s, because you have someone like Father Coughlin, who is this radio mm-hmm. priest who becomes increasingly anti-Semitic over the course of the 1930s. And Mundelein comes out against him and denounces him. So I think that he plays a pretty important role in Chicago in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of special to live a life like that and then die somewhat peacefully in your sleep. I mean, he reportedly died of heart disease, but he died while sleeping.
Yeah.
In, by the way, Mundelein, Illinois.
Yeah.
If you're going to die, die in a town that's named after you.
It's one way to go. Yeah. All right. Well, look, this is such a fascinating story. I really love it. I think we got the basic details out there.
We didn't address the cleanup crew. Cleaning up all that vomit?
That's your main question as we wrap up?
Historical mystery for the ages.
That's a very good question. Certainly not Jean Crohn's. He I think had popped out at that point. Although that would be actually a great little twist. Put on a fake mustache,
himself.
Go out there, clean up. Yeah. So if you're making the movie version of this, you can add that little one there. And then like him, he and Mundelein like lock eyes for 1 second. And then he slips out the back. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, this is a really fascinating story. And again, on our list of what ifs and foiled capers and so forth. That brings us to the end of the episode. Nicole Hemmer. Thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you, but also, let's start saying this out loud, Kelly Carter Jackson, host of the forthcoming Radiotopia podcast, Opredemics, thanks to you. Go ahead, say a couple sentences for people.
Yeah, I'm so excited. So coming this spring, we will be debuting on Radiotopia Opredemics with me and my co-host, Leah Wright-Rigger, talking about all things Oprah, the study of the Queen of Talk. And I'm so excited just to go back into her vault, her ridiculously large vault of episodes, and talk about everything that got us excited when the show was on air. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun. I've been helping sort of get this going, and it's just going to be a blast. Oprademics, academics talking about Oprah. And so if people want to go to oprademics.com right now, you can find information there, sign up for a newsletter, and be notified when the show comes. We will talk a lot more about it as the time comes, but we started to announce it. And while we're plugging stuff, we might as well say we are going to start doing a newsletter here for this day. So listeners, if you want to get on board with that, we're still figuring out exactly what it will be, but it'll be a kind of following up on some of our episodes, some other stuff from us about stuff we found interesting and so forth. So if you want to be part of that community, there's now a sign up form on our website, thisdaypod.com. Join our newsletter. So go to opredemics.com, go to thisdaypod.com, and you'll find all sorts of stuff to get involved with.
Radiotopia.